3CR acknowledges the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the lands from which we broadcast. We pay respect to elders, past and present. If you've just tuned in, hi, I'm Pauline, the Disability Day Worker for 3CR. For the next half hour, you're going to hear a couple of interviews with fantastic disabled and chronically ill anti-poverty advocates who are affiliated with the Anti-Poverty Centre. I'll also be playing some great tracks by a couple of disabled bands, so stay tuned for that too. So Anti-Poverty Centre have been doing some great work this year. It's a policy advocacy organisation that maintains that the experts on poverty are the people who live it. And there's a huge need for this kind of research led by people directly affected by social policy. Their objective is to, quote, break the poverty machine. I recently had a chance to speak with an advocate with lifelong lived experience of poverty, Melissa Fisher. Firstly, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you?
Yes, I'm Melissa. I'm 42. I have some chronic illnesses which has kept me on Job Seeker. Basically, I am doing anti-poverty advocacy. And also, I'm an artist who lives in Adelaide.
So, Melissa, earlier this year you travelled to Canberra with other members of the Anti-Poverty Centre, where you discussed social change and social policy at the Australian Social Policy Conference, and you presented the What is Expertise presentation together, and your role in that whole presentation was defining expertise in poverty. So could you tell me, what makes people like yourself, who have experienced, you know, the violence of forced poverty your whole life, poverty created by capitalism and punitive welfare, the experts on policy about it?
It's lived experience. I think part of my speech included my mother used to actually say to me, there was book smart and street smart, and sometimes someone that's not book smart is street smart. But to me, there's also poverty smart, where you get to be smart about poverty because you have to live it every day. So I found that, like, that's actually how I opened my speech in Canberra. You know, there's a lot that goes into poverty that people who haven't experienced it doesn't realise. Like, I'm constantly told they're shocked because they didn't realise that food banks can charge money. They always just assumed it was free. They don't think of the little costs involved in, like, bus fare, just, you know, being able to access certain things. You need money to access them.
And what did it mean for you to be invited to and then attend that important event in Canberra with the other members of the Anti-Poverty Centre?
So it meant growing up in poverty and then, like, well, living my whole life in poverty. I've never travelled outside of Adelaide. I had never been on a plane. So that was a whole new experience for me, and I had never done public speaking. So I think while it was very confronting and daunting for me, it was also a great experience where I could use my expertise to show other people that it's okay to speak up and speak loud about the harm that poverty is actually causing us.
And you recently attended the Anti-Poverty Networks conference, and you wrote about having attended a talk on poverty and health that got you fired up. What is the relationship between poverty and poor health? And how does bad health policy make things worse, in your opinion?
So I was surprised because, yes, I got fired up. First thing I did was write to the Australian Medical Association, and they told me that only 2% of health funding is actually spent on preventative health measures. So a couple of years ago now, I was actually diagnosed with a scurvy and malnutrition. This caused my health like overall health to become worse. My chronic illnesses became worse, and it's all because I couldn't access good food and like the things that I needed to be healthy. So I think that's what really fired me up about it, is there's so many people that I've spoken to that their health has been impacted in such a way that they're now classed as permanently disabled because they couldn't get the health help they needed because they are in poverty. Like one lady, she couldn't get physiotherapy. So because of that, she's now permanently disabled. So it's all these things that combine into, like, and the cost to Medicare, when you think about it, must be huge, because people won't go to their GP anymore because it's too expensive. So they'll wait until it snowballs into a bigger problem and then have to go to their local hospital, which costs more. And yet the government doesn't want to just raise the rate of welfare so people can access health.
So can you talk a little bit about what raise the rate is, for people who aren't familiar with the campaigning that's going on right now?
Yeah, so we're asking for all welfare payments to be the Henderson Poverty Line, which currently is at $88 a day, I believe. That would ensure that everyone's just above the poverty line, which it works out, I think, to $1,200 a fortnight. So it's not like we're asking for $1 million each or to live in luxury. We're asking to be able to afford our needs.
On a different note, you're a visual artist, and I see you sharing your art more and more online now. Could you tell us a bit about the art you make and what inspires it?
So basically, my art journey began when I was a carer for my mum. Basically, I would sit with her and draw, and found for it. And as I've like done more and more, I get inspired by things like poverty. I recently did one with elbow soup can with a rose growing out of it, meaning, you know, people could be in poverty, they're still beautiful, but they're failing. Like the rose is slowly dying because of poverty. So I get inspired by so much. Like,
finally, if people want to follow you and your advocacy, where can people find you?
Mainly on Twitter. I am on Blue Sky as well, under the same name. So it's Artist Aflame, which actually translates in French to starving artist. So I thought that was appropriate. But yeah, so Artist of Fame on Twitter. I'm on there quite a bit.
Melissa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You should smile more, whinge less, positive mindset, get up out of bed. Maybe it's all in your head. Lighten up, button up, grow up, show up, cheer up. Look on the bright side. There's always someone else who's got it worse than you. You don't look sick. I'm trying to help you. This is a wake-up call. Wake up, God!
çok zordu. Gündüz geceler içmek çok korkutucuydu. Yardım, yardım diye çağırıyordum. Uyan, uyan diye bağırıyordum.
Welcome back on Disability Day. You're listening to Breaking the Poverty Machine, a special program for 3CR's Health Sovereignty broadcast. The track you just heard was Wake Up Call by Chips. Chips is a musical project with young people from Sydney Children's Hospital Network. The track was recorded just before the big Sydney lockdown in 2021, and this track expresses the rage and frustration young people feel and being told what they should be doing or feeling about their chronic health condition. Before that, you heard an interview with Melissa Fisher, who's a Ghana country-based anti-poverty advocate who is very active on the X app, so I definitely recommend looking them up, because some days it feels like they are single-handedly talking back to the deluge of misinformation and disinformation around poverty in this country, and specifically the people who live it. So next I'm going to play an interview that was recorded by the Thursday Breakfast team with Anti-Poverty Centre's Kristen O'Connell, which speaks to a lot of the different issues that Melissa discusses in her own advocacy, but from a policy perspective. Now, this interview went to air back in late June, but beyond the references to the news cycle, everything that they discuss is still very much relevant.
I'm joined by Kristen O'Connell, who's a research and policy expert at the Anti-Poverty Centre. And Kristen is joining us to speak about the convergence between Australia's cost of living and rental crises for people living below the poverty line. Now, a note for listeners, I am a member of the Anti-Poverty Centre Committee, so just letting people know that I do have that affiliation. But even if I didn't, I would really encourage people to have a look at Anti-Poverty Centre's work, because it is absolutely vital and is all about, you know, drawing on that conversation from before, actually centering the lived expertise of people on issues that affect them. Kristen, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Priya.
I thought we could begin with the not too big issue of poverty in Australia. So, attending to speaking plainly about economic inequality is, I think, all the more pressing given the ongoing cost of living crisis. And despite a small retreat in Australia's monthly inflation rate in May, which was reported yesterday, the cumulative blowout in living costs over the past year or so has really highlighted the urgent need for redistributive social policy. So before we get into what those changes might look like, I was hoping you could speak to how, instead of spurring targeted political action at scale, the cost of living crisis has almost increased the normalization of poverty in Australia.
Yeah, thanks, Priya. If only it was a small problem, hey? Seeing the what was a very severe poverty crisis creeping up the income scale now to affect so many more people, and the total lack of urgency among political leaders to make sure that there is genuine relief for people and that they are acting to ensure that, you know, this is a crisis. We just a few years ago went through an economic crisis in response to a global pandemic. And for all of the flaws of the horrific Conservative government at the time, they took urgent action and they took action at scale. And this is a crisis that requires just such action. It is quite despairing, I suppose, to see not only the lack of action from government, but the really cynical obfuscation of what's going on and the misdirection with their rhetoric around, saying that they're there to help vulnerable people, talking themselves up as if they're doing all of these wonderful things. And I think yesterday was one of the many jarring examples of cognitive dissonance where we had the Treasurer saying in one interview that it was great that there was a higher budget surplus because it was important to take money out of the economy to control inflation. He also said yesterday in a different interview that it's great that there's a budget surplus because that's what they need to spend money to help with people who are struggling with the cost of living. So obviously these things cannot be true at the same time. And of course there is a budget surplus because they are not spending money to help people who need it. And it really seems at the moment that what they're doing is trying to find the bare minimum they can get away with so that the broader public believes action is being taken, whilst in reality very little is being done and very little money is being spent on people who need it the most, while these profligate projects are being rolled out like AUKUS and many other really expensive things, corporate tax cuts, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, it's not often that you can directly point to expenditure that could be redirected to towards, you know, social policy and, like, actually, you know, strengthening our social safety net. But AUKUS is definitely one of those things. As you said, the federal government was lauding their even bigger than expected budget surplus, but at the same time claiming that they're doing what they can to help people, quote, doing it tough, end quote. That's the language that I see used quite a lot. So this attempt to try and strike a balance between appealing to fiscally conservative voters and then trying to appear compassionate has been pretty stark. And it's included jabs at anti-poverty activists for being impractical or utopian in demands. So can you just run us through what was on the table in the May federal budget for people at the highest and lowest ends of Australia's income distribution again?
Yeah, I think it's pretty bleak if we're saying that there shouldn't be poverty is utopian. There's a lot of things that I'd have in my utopia that go a bit beyond that. In the budget, So I guess back to that issue of the fact that there is really obvious spending that could be redirected to welfare. That is true, obviously, but I guess I always want to remind people that governments have many choices and they don't actually have, it's not a zero-sum game. So if they really, really desperately need these corporate tax cuts that they say they do, they also can spend money on welfare. It's actually not a matter of one or the other. They can choose to do both if that's what their priorities are. So I think that really exposes, again, even more how low a priority they're placing on doing what is really needed to help people. So to your earlier comment about inflation, the very significant inflation slowing. and I was just commenting last night that if we had seen above 5% inflation sort of a couple of years ago, people would have been saying the sky is falling in. So 5% is certainly not looking good from a government perspective. And I think there was another figure there that if you took into account certain very volatile categories, it's still over 6%. So we have this situation where inflation is high. Inflation or CPI does not capture the increase in living costs, the lowest end of the income scale. So for most people who are surviving on bare minimum, our costs go up much faster than that. And what that means is that things in the budget, for example, a $20 a week change to the job seeker payment means that for most people, they're still actually going to be worse off than they were 6 or 12 months ago. Because things have gotten far more expensive, you know, $20 a week for most people now, for basically anyone who's had to sign a new lease, your lease has gone up if you're a renter by more than $20. That doesn't even obviously begin to touch the sides on energy prices, food prices, fuel prices, and everything else that we need. So we've got the $20 a week. We have the increase to Commonwealth rent assistance for people on social security payments is 15%, which sounds like a lot of money until you realise that Commonwealth rent assistance is basically nothing. So, for example, it's about the maximum is about $75 a week. In my case, I pay 83% of my DSP in rent, and getting an extra 15% is not going to move that needle very much at all. And, you know, I pay that much of my income in rent for a property where my windows don't close and there are many, many, many other problems with it. It's a very low standard. So these are like, you know, really nothing. The government's also talking about its $500 energy payment for a start. That actually isn't $500 in most states. For example, here in Victoria, you have a state government program that's $250 per year. So the federal government has only allowed $250 in energy payment relief for people in Victoria. Of course, the rate of increase in energy payments also means that it's far outstripping that. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the, I mean, another thing that the government has done is increase the age of the youngest child for a parent receiving parenting payment, which is good. It was changed from 16 years of age down to 8 in the early 2000s. However, the parenting payment is well below the poverty line. So there's been a lot of celebration of this change, but we still have those parents, although they are not being thrown into even deeper poverty when their kid turns 8, they're still in deep poverty. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's so many things that, as I said, are designed to look as if they're helping, but really are not doing a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, it really, these quite minimal measures in the federal budget also, you know, totally fail to take into account how expensive it is to be poor. There are cumulative costs that come with living in poverty, whether that is related to housing and infrastructure or health. There are just so many different costs that people have to factor in terms of, you know, waiting longer for medical appointments, waiting longer for dental appointments, that then leads to worsening health conditions, which is then more expensive to treat. So something that we spoke about before this interview was the wholly unproductive framing of poverty as a politically partisan issue. And this has led to some pretty toxic political discourse around people living in poverty in Australia. And ultimately, I think it fuels the objectification of people living in poverty instead of centering their lived expertise, which is how we've recently ended up with permanent income management, for example. So how do we shift the conversation out of this mire?
Yeah, and it's particularly galling, again, when we have this gaslighting from the Prime Minister, who is constantly talking about having come from public housing in his background and his mum relying on disability payments. And, you know, what he never recognises, of course, is the adequacy of those payments at the time was much greater. Access to public housing was much greater. The quality of public housing was much better. I actually live like a block from the house that he grew up in. Even now, it's obviously degraded and not being maintained, but it's probably in better shape than the private rental I'm in. So I think we've got this situation where both political parties are seeking to score points off welfare recipients, and it's been that way for a long time. The dole bludger myth was first entered Australian political discourse in the 70s under the Whitlam government when the decision was made to move away from full employment policy. And over time, we've seen that morph into the concept of welfare dependency. So we're supposed to think that these people who are suggesting that we need our lives controlled through things like the income control program and other paternalistic measures are benevolent, and they're just there to help us because we're not competent managers of our own lives. So I think there's a couple of things necessary. One is that we do need to reorient people's understanding of who should be leading conversations about poverty, and at the moment, there is no respect for the expertise of people who rely on the welfare system. We do not accept that men should make and dictate policies about women. We do not accept that, or certainly people on the progressive side of politics do not accept that disability policy, First Nations policy, policies affecting queer folks should be made by people who don't have those experiences. And it should be the same for people in poverty. So what we have been working on you know, the anti, the anti-poverty centre actually exists for this reason, right? Because we were sick of paid advocates who have no understanding of our lives being the ones getting to decide what sort of policies that should be asked for from government. We need to have this whole system removed from the hands of politicians who are trying to beat us up to win elections. We have a Fair Work Commission. We have a Reserve Bank of Australia. These are institutions that make decisions independent of government that have an enormous impact on the broader economy and on the federal budget itself. And we need to see these types of decisions put into an independent context in terms of welfare payments. And if we did do that, it would actually have a far smaller effect on the economy than those sorts of decisions from those two bodies. So we need those decisions out of politicians' hands, and we need them based on evidence. So one of the other pieces we've been working on is a proposal for a far more sophisticated measure of poverty, a modern measure of poverty. None of the poverty lines we have right now are adequate, although the Henderson poverty line, which is about $600 a week, is kind of the least bad one. When you talked earlier about things like the cost of healthcare, a really sophisticated poverty measure would first account for those costs, and then if governments did something good, for example, like make greater investment in Medicare, greater investment in public housing, that the cost of living would come down and the poverty line may reduce. So these are the kinds of things we think are pretty obvious, actually, but just aren't even in the discourse at the moment.
That was Christian O'Connell talking to Priya from 3CR's Thursday Breakfast team. You've been listening to Breaking the Poverty Machine, a special program for 3CR's Disability Day Health Sovereignty broadcast. We're going to finish now with another song from disabled artists. This is Swamp Dogs with Sick as a Dog.
I'm sick as a dog!
Feud on juice.